Welcome to The Ash, our Ghosts Reel podcast. Here we share the stories of our listeners and the paranormal experiences they have encountered. We have all heard the bump in the night and seen the shadow in the corner of the room. Here are the stories from the people who have witnessed it firsthand, so sit back and listen to the stories that Ash and his guests have in store for you.
Edinburgh. A city steeped in history, and a very fascinating history at that. Witches being burnt at the stake, a 1,000-year-old castle that overlooks the country's capital, and vaults buried underneath the city that used to house the poverty-stricken. And that's just the start. For many people, Edinburgh is a city break, but many people call it home. A beautiful city with so many stories to tell. In today's episode, my guest is going to share his stories with what Edinburgh has to offer. He himself is from Edinburgh and grew up close to the city. I hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to the latest Ash, a Ghost Reel podcast. On today's episode, we've got North Edinburgh Nightmares himself, John. How are you doing, John?
Not bad, Ash. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. So, I think we'll go straight into it with what is North Edinburgh Nightmares?
Okay, well, North Edinburgh Nightmares began about 3 years ago when I started writing a book with lesser known sort of ghost stories and sort of sinister tales of the North Edinburgh area. There were many that I'd heard of and, you know, spoke to people over the years that I couldn't find anyone else sort of online or in print about. I mean, there was a few, but the majority of them, you know, I'd spoke to local neighbours and stuff, and they say, oh, I know that one. No one else knew them. So I thought, I want to get these in a book, in print for people to read. When I was doing that, we decided to get the website going, get some of the stories up online, and with that came doing some videos telling the tales, and it's gone on to, you know, have narrated stories and other such things as well. So it's kind of grown over 3 years.
Fantastic. So from that is, like, where did you first start hearing these stories? Where did the first start hearing them, obviously as a child or even before?
Yeah, well, back in the 70s, you know, when I was growing up, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents who lived in the sort of Royston area of Edinburgh, not far from where we are now. And one of the stories, my granddad, you know, he spent a lot of time at sea. First of all, he was in the Navy and then the Merchant Navy. And, you know, he sailed on vessels out of Granton Harbour. That's where the first story he told me came from about. Right. I believe it's one, you know, we'll discuss later on. Yes. By the type of slang you are. You know, a story of a mysterious 14th crew member. You know, to introduce it. That was the first one he told me, and that got me hooked from there. And every time I was along seeing my grandparents, I was looking for different tales, not just supernatural ones, but he had plenty of those as well from his, you know, sort of time around the world. Yeah. And that's where it all stemmed from, you know, from Brilliant. The sort of late 70s onwards.
Fantastic. So what made you want to tell them then?
They were, I mean, I've told them to people over the years in various formats. When I've been kind of approaching people to see if they knew anything about them themselves, to get other leads, other people that may have sort of experienced, you know, these kind of supernatural going on. And as I said, the more that, you know, I spoke to people, the less, you know, actually heard with people out with the area that knew them. So I thought, you know, these are, you know, stories that, you know, people might be interested in. It turns out, you know, a lot of people really were, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And I think where I should start now is obviously, if you couldn't tell with the podcast, and especially with John's distinctive accent, we are in Edinburgh for these stories. And like I said, well, like we've been discussing there off air, John, Edinburgh is so rich in history. The castle itself, you've got the vaults, the ghost stories galore, really. And I bet, obviously, I bet you've got loads to tell, and I can't wait to hear them. But it just dates so far back, Edinburgh does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, starting with the castle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, I work with a chap who was in the Royal Scots. And one of the, you know, duties he used to do when he was in the Royal Scots was guard duty. Yeah. What they used to do, I don't know when it ended, but they used to have two guards all the time at the front of the castle, standing in boxes, unable to talk to the public, unable to smile, but they were stationed there all the time. So he had some crackers from his time in the castle when they were, you know, doing work overnight and stuff. And, you know, he says you wouldn't believe some of the things, even down to sort of noises and, you know, kind of things that other people had went along with and say, yeah, heard that too. So the castle for one was, you know, full of stories.
Yeah, and even in Edinburgh, apparently it's the most haunted graveyard in Scotland with the Greyfriars Crickyard as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Have you been?
I've never been myself, no, but I know it's very big reputation.
Got some history. I mean, Mackenzie Poltergeist, other parts of the Covenanters prison. 5 years ago this week, my friend and collaborator with the Northumber Nightmares was married in Greyfriars, and they had their wedding there. And even then, we were tempted to venture out, have a look around the graveyards at night. Yeah. I don't think many were too kind of brave enough.
No,
because it really has got a fearsome reputation towards the rear, the graveyard.
Fantastic. So yeah, that's really just the tip of the iceberg with Edinburgh. So I think the next question really is, what other places do you know and what stories can you share?
I know many. Starting with a few sort of ones that are slightly better known. You've got the case in the 1920s, a place called Learmonth Gardens. Now Learmonth Gardens is sort of near the Dean Village area of the city, near the Dean Bridge. And there was a case when a chap called Lord Alexander Seton visited the Temple of Elixir with his wife Zila. It was just opened by Howard Carter, founder that found Tutankhamun's tomb.
Yeah, yeah.
While they were there, have you heard this one?
No, I've not heard this one.
While they were there, his wife sneakily removed one of the bones from the exhibition and brought it back to Edinburgh.
Wow.
So they had it in a glass jar resting in their living room in Learmonth Gardens, and that is when all hell broke loose. There's some stuff documented about it. We've been to speak to neighbours, visit the property, speak to current occupiers, and there are still kind of evidence of hauntings now. But yeah, I mean, the house was exorcised. They had Howard Carter's intervention about how to deal with the bone. That was a good one. And that's been documented in sort of other things online and in books. That's quite a good one. What other ones? Let's see. I mean, do you want me to just rattle through a few for you?
Yeah, go for it. Absolutely go for it, yes.
Right where we are right now is just across from Wardy Bay, also known as Grimmington Harbour. Mm. And this was another one of the stories that my grandfather, told me from the area, because he used to sort of work across, in the harbour as a trawlerman. In the 60s, there was a chap working for one of the many trawler boat companies that were along on Lower Granton Road. He'd finished his shift. He came along to what was called the Wardy Hotel, which is kind of a door along from where I am. Instead of taking the long way around that he usually took, going round Lower Granton Road to Granton Square, he decided to take a shortcut of what is known as the Wardy Steps. Hmm. The Wardy Steps is maybe 100 steps going up a steep passageway that takes you onto Granton Road. Now, the story goes that along the way that night, he came face to face with something kind of sinister, making a noise, rattling. There was three bars at the top of the steps. Now there's only two, I don't know why. And they were there to stop people from stealing fish, pockles of fish from the harbour. So whatever it was that he saw was rattling the bars ferociously, and he ended up unconscious at the top of the steps, discovered by a policeman. So whenever I've went past those steps, I've always kept that at the back of my mind. So years later, I spoke to a couple other people that knew this story. One of them was a plasterer called Rab. He was working on the middle of the Wardy steps. And again, he heard something coming down the stairs. He thought it was maybe an old lady with a trolley and a clump, clump, clump. So he went out to see if they needed a hand. So when Rab stuck his head out, there was not a soul on the steps. There was no sound of the ringing bars this time. There was one other story, when we were sort of youngsters in the area, of a girl that lived in it was known as the Royal Fourth Yacht Club. It's now on Granton Pier. It used to be at the top of the steps in a massive property that overlooked these steps. So the girl was forever coming in late. Her parents were always worried about her. Mm. And this one was exceptionally late. And when her parents found her nearby in sort of waste ground, she claimed that the reason she didn't come up the steps was she saw a similar figure to what was described by Rab and the chap from the trawler company years ago. And after the school holidays, the family left. She never returned. So that, you know, I like to think there was a little bit of gravity to that story.
Wow.
So that was the Wordy Step story.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So I suppose then, is have you had any paranormal experiences yourself?
Okay. Only once. I mean, I'll say this, you know, I've never, I'm more interested in the sort of history of the places and the stories that go with them rather than the actual looking to discover ghosts and the like. I've never really had a try at that.
No.
But what happened was, it was about 2014, and a friend of mine who was working as a security guard for a company, I can't remember the name, but what it entailed was, if an alarm went off somewhere, he'd get in the car, go out, make sure the place was secure, that there was no one breaking in. One of the places he went to was Bangour Village Hospital, right. Which is a famous place for sort of urban explorers. Well, that was a different story. He was asked if he wanted to do some overtime for the weekend, and it was a place called Craig Crook Castle.
Right.
Now, Craig Crook is in the Black Hall area of Edinburgh. It's currently for sale, if you've got a 6 million spare quid. And one of the people that was going to buy it was the actor, I can never remember the guy's name, Scottish actor, anyway. He was in something, Has Fallen, Olympus Has Fallen.
Oh, Gerard Butler, yes, yeah.
He was one of the guys who was going to buy it and changed his mind. So anyway, this guy says, I'll do the shift, no worries. 16-hour shift. The only condition was every hour he had to walk around the building with a torch, check it over, which he did. So the first hour, came back to the office, shut the drawer, sat down, you know, had his cup of tea. Went on second trip round the castle, came down, drawer open again. Shut the drawer, thought nothing of it. 6 times this happened before he realised, he said, I'm not doing this anymore. You know, this door's opening by itself, there's something odd here. So he told me later in that year, he says, I was at a spooky old place, you like things like that. Do you want to check it out next time I get a chance?
Wow.
So he did. Later that year, we went along, we took lots of pictures, it was about 11 o'clock at night, fascinating big castle, you know, deserted. And nothing supernatural there. So he was coming to the end of that job and he said, I've got the keys one more time. Do you want to come back for one final look at it? And that's when we did see something a bit strange. Now, it turns out on record that the castle was owned and now haunted by a Lord Jeffrey. He stayed there in 1815.
Wow.
And he said to manifest the second floor of the building. So we went in, we went round and said, do you want to have a cup of tea? We'll go and do the walk round first, which we did. And we went on the first floor. Now, I must say, the other thing is there's no power in this place. It's done torches. There's a generator in the ground floor. So we went along the first floor, all good, you know. Up through the sort of spiral staircase and onto the second. And the first thing we noticed was a door opening by itself. And I thought, it's nothing, could be a floorboard, could be anything. So as we went along the second floor, the next weird thing that happened was a big brass handle just fell off right at our feet. And about 5 seconds after, another door violently flew open and the smell of flowers just flooded the hall. And it's at the point where the two of us legged it. You know, it was 2 in the morning. I says, I'm out of here. And he says, I'm not staying either. And we locked up and left. That was the only kind of instance of something slightly supernatural that, you know, I couldn't explain. The doors opening, the smell of flowers and the big brass handle flying off the door.
That's fantastic. That's a great story.
I've got good pictures as well from the second visit, you know.
So, like you've been saying though, like you've just reeled off different places in Edinburgh. So why do you think Edinburgh is like such a hotbed for paranormal activity?
I don't have a solid answer to that, Ash, but I think it may just be due to the age. I mean, how old Edinburgh is and all the things that have happened over the years with the plague, you know, the place being sealed over, you know, the tragedies that have happened in the time, the things that have happened in the islands out in the Forth. There's a rich history with Inchkeith Island, with your plague victims being used there for, you know, quarantined on it. A strange linguistic experiment happened with King James II. Other, you know, things that all add up to sort of Edinburgh's, you know, kind of bloody history, if you will. I think that must play a part in it.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I was going to allude to next, is that obviously with Edinburgh, you've got like the notorious paranormal stories of the vaults, the castle, obviously witches being burnt at the stake. Mm. And I think as sad as it sounds, you've got the people who are poor going to live in the vaults, and obviously you've even got the rumours of Burke and Hare going into the vaults. Yeah. It's so rich, but it's such a, they are grisly tales, which, yes, I think that's what fascinates me about Edinburgh, because they're not just kings and queens in castles. It's not about that. It's the darker side to it. It's the people of Edinburgh.
Yes.
That fascinate these stories. It's not that kings or queens, it's the people themselves. So from that, is there one place or is there multiple places that you'd like to visit in Edinburgh, and why?
I can think of a couple. I mean, one that stands out is I've never actually been to the vaults that you mentioned. Yeah. I've heard lots about them. I've never had the opportunity to go there. I've been to Mary King's Close maybe three times. The first being in about 1995, when it wasn't open to the public. I was lucky enough to get on a sort of Edinburgh Council tour where you could go on a party and see it before it really took shape. You know, it was very basic back then, and that was pretty scary. But this the vault, from what I've read about it and how it was discovered, would be fascinating. I'd love to see that.
It's quite a strange way that the vaults were refounded, really. Obviously, I think it was a Scottish rugby player trying to hide a Romanian rugby player. And that's how the vaults were originally refounded. I think it was either the 80s or the 90s, maybe earlier. And yeah, it's quite a weird way of it opening. And then it's a massive part of Edinburgh tourism now. Obviously, people want to visit Edinburgh for the vaults, for the castle and stuff like that. But yeah, it's weird how things like that occur.
Another one that, you know, holds interest, I've never been to that, I know people have, is the Gilmerton Coves, which, you know, up in Gilmerton, obviously. And it's got some history of being used as a hellfire. Place of the Hellfire Club, the infamous Hellfire Club. Rumours of, you know, sacrifice and all kinds of stuff. You know, altars in it, and I'd love to go there. Yeah. It's just kind of getting the time to do it.
I think as well, the people of Edinburgh do take pride in that history, the grisly tales and stuff like that, even down to the point where there's the ghost of the dog as well that roams the streets. I think it's the Grey Friars dog, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, sorry.
No, I'm just acknowledging the story of the dog.
Yeah, so it is fascinating that obviously people do take note of this. So I don't know if you've got any more stories that you'd like to share.
I've got as many as you want.
Go for it.
Right, not far from here is a good one. If we go along, you know, slightly, you know, towards the left of me, you come to one of the stately homes of the area. I mean, there's maybe five or six, Craig Crook Castle being one of them. But closer to there is a place by the name of Caroline Park House. Now, Caroline Park House was on the site of what used to be Royston Castle back, I think, the 1500s or something, I'm not sure. It's an impressive-looking building. It was twinned with the same architect that designed Holyrood Castle. I was lucky enough to speak to a friend of my mum's. My mum's 84, and she was telling me, you know, some stories of her friends who used to play there when they were kids, and it was supposedly haunted by the ghost of the Green Lady, which is, you know, reputedly to be Lady Royston, you know, from it was the castle. She's been to see, you know, floating from a well, walking across the forecourt of the building and disappearing through windows. There's also been a cannonball bouncing across the, you know, through the wall and across the floor of the building. But the best one, most recently, I was lucky enough to speak to a lady who actually lived there in 1976. She had a big plan drawn out for me of what the building was like, the different levels, and, you know, it was a very different place back then. It was completely remote. Now there's a supermarket, there's all kinds of industry around there, but back then there was nothing. And one night when she was looking after babysitting and there was no one out, it's no one in, she heard a big commotion upstairs in an architect's office by the name of Ian Ronald Architects. Desks flying around, drawers being thrown around the room, and she thought, oh, it was burglars, locked the door, her and the kid she was looking after, locked in, and she could see lights across the courtyard and thought that must be the burglars in the other room. So as, you know, the night passed and the next day, you know, family members returned, she said what had happened. They went up, nothing, not a soul in the building. She spoke to the architect the following day, says, someone's done a number on your office, it's trashed, nothing, not a thing moved. The one other story she told me that was of interest was when her and her friend were in the loft of Caroline Park House, there was a dumb waiter that would move on its own with no one in the building. Imagine how terrifying that would be to suddenly see this thing here. Yeah. And you're up there on your own. So it's certainly got some good stories about Caroline Park House.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So from that, I think it's fair to say, would do you think ghosts are real? And this is what the podcast is all about. The podcast is essentially, I'm speaking to people of interest who are passionate about the paranormal, that really take to it. Obviously yourself, a fantastic storyteller, you've gathered masses of stories, I've loved hearing them, but I always allude to this in the podcast, are ghosts real?
I would have to say that from all the books I've read, from all the places I've visited, because Edinburgh is only like a small part of where I visit. I spend half the time down in England with my family, down in Hampshire, so I spend a lot of time visiting sites down there. Oh. And the sheer amount of, you know, stories, etc., can't be a coincidence. It's impossible. Yeah. Especially with the Isle of Wight, where my in-laws live on the Isle of Wight. Yeah. That place is a hotbed of incredible paranormal activity. It has been for hundreds of years. Yeah. I'd say most definitely yes. Fantastic. After the Great Crook Castle adventure, definitely. I couldn't explain that.
No, fantastic. And this is what it's all about. It's like I said on my previous podcast, it's there can't be smoke without a fire.
Yes.
So from that,
the people who try and debunk the stories, you know, the one question is why? You know, yeah. I mean, it's there's nothing to gain from it.
No.
So I certainly do believe in ghosts.
Definite. Brilliant. So I'd like to thank you for listening to the podcast. And John has got some amazing stories to finish us the podcast with. And I do appreciate your time, John, and thank you for coming on. It really has been a pleasure.
It's been a privilege. Excellent. Okay, so I believe you're going to play three stories. Are you going to play all three of them, Ash?
I'm going to play all three of them. So if you could introduce all three, that'd be fantastic.
The first story is one of the first stories that my grandfather told me when I was a youngster. Now, this is a story by the title of Slangivar. Slangivar means good health. In the story, a trawler boat leaves Granton Harbour sailing to the Shetland Isles. Along the way, you know, they come across, let's say, a mysterious 14th crew member. I'll say no more about the story. I'll let you watch it for yourself or listen to it yourself. But that was one of the first. The second one is a story called God Bless You, Who Are You? Now, this was another local story told by my grandparents about an incident back in the 50s, from not far from when they lived. It involves an acquired piece of furniture that they wish they'd never set their eyes on. So that is God Bless You, Who Are You? Have a listen to that if you want. The final one is one I recorded recently, and it tells a story of a place in the Trinity area of Edinburgh, and the title is The Watcher of Steadfast Gate. Now, Steadfast Gate, it was constructed in 1983, features a very old part of Edinburgh history called the Sinclair Fountain. Whether there is a connection with, you know, anything to do with the fountain, I don't know. But if you listen to this story, make sure you tune in right to the end and give it a listen and see what you think.
And I'd love to add that The Watcher of Steadfast Gate is personally my favourite that I've listened to. And it's definitely keeps you gripped right to the end. So, we'll finish it there. Thank you very much, John. I really have appreciated you coming on. And here are John's stories. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Slangivar by John Tantallon. My grandfather was a terrific storyteller. As a youngster, I spent much time with my grandparents and was fortunate enough to hear his many recollections from around the world. He served in the Royal Navy and achieved the rank of Chief Petty Officer. During World War II, he served on minesweeping duties across the Forth Estuary.
When the war ended, my grandfather commenced a new career at sea as a trawlerman. It is here that the story begins. During his years working for HMT, His Majesty's Trawlers, my grandfather sailed on many trawler ships out of Granton Harbour and the Forth. The routes would lead as far as Iceland, the Faroe Islands. In his words, the fish in those seas were monsters of the deep. During one particular voyage, crew of the vessel, named the Alma, witnessed something very unusual. The crew could amount to as many as 13 men on a voyage, dependent on distance. One of the crew members, who went by the name of Geordie Walker, was situated at the rear of the Alma, working on maintenance. Suddenly, from out of nowhere, a substantial wave lashed the vessel. The torrent battered the unaware trawler and sending him over the side of the boat and into the icy depths of the water. The crew members immediately ran to aid their colleague from the sea. Incredibly, before they could reach him, Geordie Walker returned catapulted from the water and launched back onto the deck of the Alma, on the opposite side of the boat. The fortunate man had travelled beneath the vessel and back onto the deck above in a dramatic stroke of luck. The crew took Geordie below and resuscitated the shivering man. After a while, he regained composure and was ready to talk about the incident with the team. The boat captain could not comprehend how Geordie came to go overboard. Geordie was a hardened naval man and had sailed on many voyages previously. That size of a wave would not usually catch such a crew member off the guard. Geordie then relayed a very different version of events to the attentive crew. The visibly terrified man claimed that when the moment the tide had struck him, he stood confronted by another crew member, one he did not recognise and had never seen before. The man had either attempted to push him overboard or tried to grab him to save him. The captain stated that this was impossible and he must have imagined it, the shock of being in such icy waters. However, Mr. Walker was adamant that the man had stood before him and managed to describe him right down to the tattoo on his left hand. The mysterious 14th man had the word Slangivar, meaning good health, and a thistle below it tattooed on his hand. He remembered the design as clear as day. It was at this point that my grandfather paused and returned to his duties. The rest of the trip went without incident. The crew landed a successful catch and returned to Granton making good time. The Alma docked at the middle pier of Granton Harbour and the crew concluded their duties and made their way to the nearby Granton Tap pub. The crew, now comfortable and seated in the confines of the Granton Tap pub, my grandfather took Geordie Walker aside and told him a story. The previous year, the crew of the Alma returned from a successful trip to the waters around the Shetland Isles. The crew were departing the vessel one by one, preparing to unload the catch onto the pier, when tragedy struck. A local man who went by the name of Mr. Ross lost his footing on the steep metal ladder that ascended the middle pier. The man crashed headfirst onto the hard wooden deck of the Alma, the force of the impact so severe that it split his head clean in two. My grandfather attempted to hold the terrible wound together and call out for help as poor Mr. Ross passed in and out of consciousness. Eventually, the life drained from his still fractured body. When help arrived, they attempted to feel for a pulse on the dead operate's hand. The cold dead hand with the word Slangivar tattooed upon it. God Bless You, Who Are You? By John Tantallon. A long time ago, I heard a story of a terrifying incident which happened not far from where my grandparents lived. It was back in the 1950s. An elderly neighbour by the name of Angus Anderson died alone in the house a few doors along from my grandparents. A week or so later, there was a sale of the older man's personal effects. A neighbour by the name of Agnes Parson attended the auction in old Anderson's house and managed to acquire a large, foreboding and ancient brass bed. The grand old piece, delivered to the house by a couple of local lads, erected in one of the two rooms on the same day of the sale. The Parson family consisted of Jock, Agnes and their six children. Jock, a trawlerman, spent much time at sea. Agnes spent her days running about after the children and keeping the house in as ship-shape condition as possible. It was the first evening after the arrival of the new grand piece of furniture, and the first to venture to bed that evening was six-year-old Christopher. The other children played out until late due to summertime and the middle of the school holidays. It was around 7 p.m. and still light outside when Christopher returned from the bedroom and into the living room to confront his mother. Christopher claimed that the bed was moving and that somebody had joined him in the vicinity and not a family member. Agnes promptly returned the sobbing youngster to the dark confines of the bedroom and instructed him to get to sleep. It was lighting up time and Agnes began to try to round up the Parson children from their evening activities and get them in for the night. It was at this point when she suddenly stood alerted to loud cries from the bedroom that Christopher slept. The terrified Christopher sat frozen and upright, pointing to the far corner of the room.
Mum! Mum! There's someone in the room!
Agnes, frustrated by the child's continued disturbance, yelled at him to get to sleep and insisted that his delusions were nothing more than nightmares. Christopher grudgingly agreed and clambered back beneath the sheets to attempt to sleep. It was now 9 p.m. and all children in and settled for the night. There had been no further disturbance from the room and Agnes presumed Christopher to be fast asleep. After getting two of the younger children dressed for bed, they quietly entered the bedroom to accompany their younger brother. Upon entering the door, Agnes and the children stood confronted by Christopher sitting upright in the newly acquired brass bed, looking into the corner of the room. He was not alarmed and crying out like before, but appeared to be in conversation with somebody or something. Agnes asked the wide-awake youngster who he was talking to, which he calmly replied,
"It's the old man over there, Mum. He wants his bed back."
Christopher Parson not only described an older man fitting the exact description of Old Man Anderson, but an account of someone he had never clapped eyes on in his life. Agnes attempted to play off the youngster's incredible story as more bad dreams and get the other children to bed, which she did, but deep down she understood the predicament all too well. Earlier that year, Agnes visited a local spiritualist woman by the name of Mrs. Rutherford. During her reading, Mrs. Rutherford informed Agnes that a spirit would visit and request an item from her property. Mrs. Rutherford instructed Agnes not to be afraid when this should occur, but to relay the following words to the spirit.
"God bless you. Who are you?"
This action is precisely what Agnes did that night after the children lay tucked up in bed. The following day, Agnes, along with the help of a couple of neighbours, removed the bed from the property and dumped the large and foreboding brass structure down a nearby lane. There were no more sightings of Old Man Anderson. The story became that of legend, until last year. I was visiting an elderly relative from the Royston area at sheltered accommodation. He had a visitor that night by the name of Janice, Chris Parson's daughter. Janice told me a comical story that she thought may enjoy due to my interest in local folklore. was the story of a strange old bed she acquired many years ago when she moved out of the family home. She informed me of strange dreams and the thought of somebody watching her from the corner of the room. Did Agnes really ditch the bed after all? The Watcher of Steadfast Gate by John Tantallon. Today is the 1st of December 2019. 20 years ago, this very month, something strange occurred on a remote path on an Edinburgh walkway. Steadfast Gate officially opened in 1983 to commemorate the anniversary of the Boys' Brigade. The path furnished with an old Edinburgh landmark named the Sinclair Fountain, previously from Princes Street and moved in 1926. It was the first days of December 1999 when a cyclist on the walkway turned off from Steadfast Gate and proceeded to cycle along the path that led towards nearby Bonnington Bridge. The conditions that evening became frosty and the trails unoccupied. The cyclist thought it odd to see a sleeping bag beneath the bridge, considered it the home for the night for some poor soul. As the cyclist continued along the solitary path and towards the bridge that crossed South Fort Street, he suddenly noticed a dark figure walking ahead of him, moving in the same direction. As he drew closer, the cyclist saw that the shape was dressed entirely in black, with no facial features. He presumed that the figure was wearing a balaclava or scarf, continued to cycle towards him and proceeded to safely pass. As he reached the figure, the tall, dark shape suddenly lunged towards him, nearly knocked him from his bike. With a struggle, the traveller managed to stay upright and pass the figure with all the speed he could achieve. As the cyclist reached the Junction Street Bridge, he noticed a female jogger and hastily stopped to warn her of the oncoming danger. He turned and could still see the shape approaching through the darkness of the path and urged her to turn back. With an incredible twist of fate, at that exact moment, two police officers turned from the nearby Coburg Street and began to walk along the path towards the Junction Street Bridge. The thoroughly relieved cyclist immediately relayed the story to the police officers and urged them to apprehend the strange character who approached them. When the police officer raised his torch to get a better look at the figure, all present were shocked beyond belief to see that the man had vanished. There was nowhere that the man could have gone to. On one side was the Water Leith and on the other dense bushes and buildings with no easy exit. The nearby steps that led to Largo Place remained sealed off, closed for repairs. Where exactly could the figure have vanished to? The cyclist, jogger and two police were wholly baffled and made their way away from the walkway and onto North Junction Street, where they parted ways, never spoke again. However, this was not the first time that something strange had occurred near Steadfast Gate. In the summer months of 1994, a dog walker from the Warriston area named Elaine, while out walking that evening, stopped to take in the sound of the fireworks from the opening of the Edinburgh Military Tattoo. Elaine was alone with her dog Duke that night and quite happy in the familiar setting of the Steadfast Gate walkway. She stood by the Water Leith and took in the fantastic early evening fireworks display. Although 9 o'clock at night, the sky was still light and the path deserted from other walkers and travellers. As Elaine turned around to walk towards the direction of Victoria Park, she noticed a solitary dark figure standing by the raised platform of Steadfast Gate. Taking the stranger to be a fellow attendee of the fireworks display, Elaine greeted them with a cry of,
"Hello there, hello."
The figure did not reply and instead stared silently. The lone woman walked from the path with her dog. Elaine became alarmed as the stranger in black continued to stare at her as she walked towards the park. As the lone dog walker passed the entrance to Steadfast Gate, the woman was terrified to see that the stranger in black had vanished. In the spring of 1991, a couple from the Trinity area by the name of Mr. and Mrs. Saunders walked the path towards Steadfast Gate that afternoon with their grandson, Lewis. The couple pushed the child's buggy past Steadfast Gate and along the walkway towards North Junction Street. The previous week, at that same spot, Mr. Saunders had spotted a shop till lying on the grass directly below the North Junction Bridge. He thought nothing of the matter, but at the back of his mind imagined it to contain the cash from a bungled robbery. This week, however, the till had vanished, but in its place was a single shopping bag behind a tree. The carrier bag, emblazoned with the familiar logo of Edinburgh Capital Meat Centre, sat there tucked away. Mr. Saunders could not resist the temptation, and although his wife protested, approached the bag and removed it from behind the tree. The contents of the bag were substantial, and although packed with bubble wrap, something heavy sat within. The curious Mr. Saunders wrestled with the tightly wrapped package, imagining the materials to contain last week's loot from the till. His wife hesitantly watched as her husband shook the plastic bag repeatedly. With each persuasion, the contents moved closer and closer to the entrance of the pack. Then, with a mighty push, the contents rolled from the plastic and exited the bubble wrap packaging. To the horror of the couple, the discarded wrapping revealed an old and rotten, severed human head. Immediately, the couple retrieved their unaware grandson and ran from the scene of the hideous find as fast as possible. The couple phoned the police from the nearby Up the Junction cafe and waited from the Junction Street Bridge to confirm the hideous find. The police arrived with dogs but could not find anything that day. Mr. Saunders even phoned a friend from Fettes Police Station, but the answer was a very much negative on anything sinister from the reported area. The shocked couple made their way back to their home in Trinity that afternoon. After dropping Lewis off, they climbed the steps to their house and were both completely stunned to see a plastic carrier bag sitting outside their front door. The mud-covered carrier, emblazoned with the words Capital Meat Centre, sent a shiver down their spine. The couple slowly ascended the final steps to their property, with an eye on the hideous plastic bag. As Mr. Saunders reached the bag, he plucked up the utmost courage to stand over the bag and peer inside. A wave of relief crept over the terrified man as he realised that the rotund shape of the carrier bag was nothing more than their neighbour's muddy, but not so bloody, football.